Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, a thank you for joining me as we continue to go through this big old monster box of baseball cards through the land of misfit cardboard. Well, we're in that era of baseball cards. The junk era, as some people call it. Late 80s, early 90s, we're wrapping up our final look at a set from 1991. 91 Tops, one of my favorite sets. And I'm glad when I purged most of my collection about 10 or 12 years ago, I am glad I hung on to many of these cards. This is one of those sets that I was hand collating. I haven't completed it yet. I mean, there's like 12 cards left I got to get from this. But it's a beautiful set. I love it. And I call it the last of the fun baseball card sets. And I will explain that in a little bit. We'll also take a look at our random poll, card number 68, Gary Sheffield, then of the Milwaukee Brewers. He had a very lengthy career, very controversial career on and off the field, and he's moved on to the world of player agent, so he can still be controversial on and off the field, but at least he gets a nice little percentage of the cut. And if you've seen some of the contracts that are being signed these days, now is a good day, a good time to be a player agent in Major League Baseball. And once again, I ask you to please forgive me for my stuffiness as I'm still dealing with the sinus infection. You know, it always happens this time of year. And again, I blame our goofy weather here in Florida. It's 85 one day, it's 65 the next, it's 85 the next day. Bees are still pollinating plants around here. It's just a mass hysteria on a nature level. So I actually feel a lot better than I sound, trust me. But just roll with me here, okay? We'll get through this podcast together. So we'll talk 91 Tops. We'll talk Gary Sheffield as well. After we talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, picked up a lot of new followers this week. Also, a lot of new listeners to the podcast. Thank you very much. As always, I encourage you to share the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed with your friends, your collector friends, those who still collect, or maybe those who haven't collected in many, many years, but they'll remember the good old days of pulling these cards out of wax packs and boxes and rack packs, you name it. And at the very least, it's a nice little walk down memory lane. And of course, we encourage you to spread the word that Wax Ecstatic, non-nasal editions, normally come out to you twice a week, every Tuesday and Friday, via Audio Boom and iTunes. And as I mentioned, we're wrapping up 1991, so we'll go through the gauntlet of sets from 1992, starting on Tuesday. And let's see, which one did we start? We had Leaf. I don't think I have 92 Leaf. There's a couple of sets from 92 I completely divested myself from. Let me see. What should we start with next time around? We'll do 92 Bowman. We'll do 92 Bowman on Tuesday. That was another step forward for that set. Certainly a departure from previous sets of Bowman. And that is a name that I saw on a lot of our top 10 worst list. Now, this list actually came together a couple of podcasts ago. We covered 91 Fleer. And by far, 91 Fleer is one of the most disliked sets in the history of baseball cards. And I asked, can you share your top 10 worst sets? And because of the holidays, I didn't follow up with a scheduled tweet to kind of stoke the fire a little bit. So, we had a couple of submissions in our last podcast. So I put the question out again, sent out the Twitter notice, and got plenty of responses. A few people actually did a complete top 10 list. Others just mentioned a handful of sets off the top of their heads, and that's perfectly acceptable. So let's take a look at one of the top 10. This is from Waxtopia. Based on design, number one, 90 Tops. That's a bit of a surprise. I've liked 90 Tops. I know for some people it's not their favorite, but to see it number one, surprising to me, maybe not to other collectors, but Waxtopia continues with 90 Fleer. Oh, that's sacrilege. I love 90 Fleer. Listen to our 90 Fleer podcast on John Smoltz. You'll understand why. 89 Score, number three. Yep, 91 Donruss, number four. 92 Fleer, he's got listed as number five. I'm going to differ on that. We're going to talk 92 Fleer sometime within the next few podcasts. Certainly because 91 Fleer was such a train wreck, I thought 92 Fleer was a better set. Certainly in design, maybe not necessarily value. That was, again, one of those gluttonous sets with millions of cards produced. Number 6, 88 Donruss, a poster child of baseball card sets that people hate. 88 Fleer at number 7. Interesting ones at number 8 and number 9. I say interesting because this is when I actually stopped collecting the baseball cards. I stopped pretty much after 1993. For a number of reasons, which I will steer you to podcast number 1 if you want to hear all those reasons there. But, you know, the short story is I was 16. My disposable income was going towards fixing up cars and trying to get dates. So all of a sudden, you know, when you have, what do they say, girls and gasoline and greenbacks, all of a sudden your spending priorities change. And that certainly happened. He mentions from the era that I didn't collect, and actually looking at these cards, I don't blame you one bit. 97 Tops, which is pretty dull. That was a pretty dull set, even though there were some pretty good players, rookies and young stars that were coming out there. And number 9, 2004 Tops. Yeah, that was a pretty bland. You know, it's almost like Tops was trying to razzle-dazzle the 1964 set, and that certainly didn't come to fruition. And then number 10, 82 Fleer, which I wholeheartedly believe, and personally I think 82 Fleer needs to be, if not top 3, top 5. Going back just quickly on the time that I didn't collect cards. So basically, 1994, I bought one pack of 94 Tops. Didn't like them. I maybe bought another pack of baseball cards from 1994. But, you know, not only was it girls and gasoline and greenbacks, but of course the baseball strike in 1994, I stopped collecting from 94 to about 2005, maybe 2004. Now, I shouldn't say I stopped collecting. I still would collect older cards. And by that, I mean from the 50s and 60s and 70s. I had always collected those, even when I was a little kid, you know, 10 or 11 years old. And recently, Topps put out, I shouldn't say recently, it's a couple months back, they put out, I think it was a graph of their number one card from every year. And that is card number one. What did it look like every year? And, you know, I'm going through it and I'm getting a lot of great memories looking at all the cards, certainly from the 80s, you know, when I was a kid, but even before I collected the 70s and the 60s and the 50s. And I looked at the card sets from 95 to 2004. And I have to say, I really didn't miss that much, did I? There was just cards were not that good in those years. So I'm glad I kind of, you know, skip that time because the cards were not that great. And certainly the market kind of sorted itself out there where Topps is still the only licensed Major League Baseball card produced. And there are plenty of names under the Topps umbrella. So there's still a lot of brands out there, but it's not to the extent that it was in the mid-90s. All right, let's take a look at some of the other top 10 worst sets, or worst sets in general, because, again, a lot of people just chimed in with two or three. Calcutt, almost all from that 89-94 window. There's actually quite a few people who have that feeling. Doug McCready, 81, 86, and 70, presumably talking Topps on all of those. 81 is a set, and I said this in our 1981 Topps podcast with Screamin' Tim Stoddard. I said 81 is one of those sets you either love it or you don't. I like it. A lot of people don't. 86 is the same type of set. I never really was big on 86 Topps, but I know a lot of people really love it. 70 Topps, that's an interesting one. It is a little boring. However, I don't think it's as boring as 69 Topps. 69 Topps is quite literally a collection of photographs with a price sticker on it, in my opinion. Although 69 Topps, you've got a great assortment of rookie cards from that year. So if you're just looking at design, 69 Topps is probably not your favorite. But if you're looking at actual quality cards, yeah, 70 takes a step back from 69. Alfred, anything Bowman. Now, like I said, that name comes up quite a bit during this conversation. Peter Steinberg, all those Myriad Star sets from the late 1980s and early 1990s. I remember those. Those were not that good. And that's a name brand that I totally forgot about. I think Star was trying to be You know what triple play eventually became? You know, kind of that fence line between minor league and major league. Yeah, star cards were, first of all, very boring. There were a whole lot of them. And they were pretty cheap, too. You know, we kind of mocked Donruss for being flimsy, as some people call it. Yeah, star cards were definitely flimsy. They were not that good. All right, voice of the collector. Here is a shocking selection. This will actually upset quite a few people. 87 Tops. What? I thought everybody loved 87 Tops. Well, apparently not voice of the collector. Also not a fan of 91 Donruss or 91 Fleer. I know there's quite a few people who agree with you. Ryan Cracknell, 91 Fleer. Again, that's just like the Bowman sets, the early Bowman sets. That one comes up early and often in this conversation. Now, Ryan continues, however, except the Provisions. Love the Provisions. And if you don't know, that's the technical name for the art cards. And I thought Fleer actually did some pretty good job creating the art cards or Provisions. So that, I think, was the one saving grace of 91 Fleer, other than the fact that I didn't buy or collect too many of them. John Ragusa, yep, I'd say this pick covers them all. Zillions of that crap printed. Now, the pick refers to the picture we attached to the tweet, and basically it's just a collection of wax packs and cello packs from, 89, 90, 91, around there. There's an 81 Fleer that's dropped in there as well. And he's obviously not a big fan of him. He says probably 70% still unopened in a warehouse, junk wax. Now, if you're looking to make a fortune off of these or not really waste your money, then yeah, it's junk wax. If you're really more just kind of going through them because you want to relive a little bit of your childhood and there are some cards that are designed better than others, I don't call it junk wax. And part of the reason why I've enjoyed doing this podcast, and especially through the quote-unquote junk wax era, is there have been a few sets that the more I look at them, the more I appreciate them now than I did 25 or so years ago. Case in point, 89 Bowman. I know a lot of people don't like it, but I've said, give it a second chance. 90 Bowman as well. What's another one? 91 Score. It's because that set was so massive, a lot of people don't like it. But, you know, there's some sets from these years. 90 Fleer, another one I said, you know what, just take a look at them. Give them another chance. Question, based on that picture, Mr. Mint 23, never seen 89 cents on a Topps pack. And again, this refers to that picture. That is a 90 Topps cello pack. Somehow a cello pack got mixed in with all those other wax packs there. Let's see. Oh, guess what? 91 Fleer, Tim Carroll. Even I have a difficult time finding use for the 91 Fleer. Has to be number one. To which Ryan Cracknell responds, may come in handy for a San Diego chicken portrait. I never thought of that. You know, I mentioned you could use 91 Fleer along with your extra 90 Donruss cards to wallpaper the portion of your bathroom behind the toilet. Because that's often the neglected part of the paint job or wallpaper job in a house. And I never thought of true art. If you wanted to make, never mind a fathead San Diego chicken, if you wanted to make a San Diego chicken out of 91 Fleer cards, you probably could do it. There's your homework assignment, if you so choose to go ahead and do it. Now, Brian Hayes actually brings up a very interesting question here. He says, was there ever really a junk wax era? And if you follow along in our timeline of wax and gum stains, you will see that he links up to a story asking that question, a story that he wrote. And it's very interesting about the whole junk wax era. And I encourage you to read it because I think he brings up some very valid points there. Was it really junk? Or is it just because of the overproduction, we just don't quite have the same feelings for it? He does add, I like most sets from that era, but not 89 Bowman, the worst. You see a common thread here. Tyler Kepner, 81 and 82 Fleer and Donruss. I wouldn't say they're necessarily the worst. Well, 82 Fleer is up there. But if you listen back to our podcast on both of those years and both of those sets, you will see I was... I liked some of the baby steps, especially Donruss in those early years. But for Fleer, it took them until 83 to figure it out. For Donruss, in my opinion, 84. And then they produced some very good sets throughout the 1980s. Lucas Frank, 91 Donruss baseball. So all sorts of great suggestions here. But as I mentioned in that last podcast, a lot of these, if we were to assemble a definitive top 10 list, you're going to see a lot of people are suggesting the same sets. I think there's probably five or six sets that everybody agrees on. 89 Bowman, despite my best efforts to have people give it a second chance. That's definitely up there. 90 Donruss. 91 Fleer is definitely up there. 82 Fleer as well. And some people don't like 86 Tops. So that might make the top 10 lower end of the scale. But yeah, you see a lot of repetition there. So it's pretty obvious which sets were hits and which ones were misses. One last thought from our Twitter feed here. Daily Mets Card chimes in, loves the recent podcast, of course, talking about our 91 Top Stadium Club podcast. Definitely missed the days of Sears JCPenney Christmas catalog. Spent many hours looking and dreaming. Good memories. Yeah. And you know, the last podcast, that wasn't the only time I mentioned the catalogs. I don't recall which other podcast. We've done it a couple times before where we talk about, you know, going through the catalogs or going through the backs of magazines. Back when, you know, when baseball card sales were really starting to ramp up, especially in the mid to late 80s. And, you know, one example that I recall, I was an Eagle Scout and I used to get Boys Life magazine, and you could flip to the back of the Boys Life magazine and they would sell card sets. Now, they didn't do it as much in the early 90s, but, you know, I started Boy Scouts, I think 1988. Well, my scout troop had an archive of old magazines, so I would pick up a few of the magazines and, you know, look back from, you know, 83, 84, 85. And they're selling those complete sets for like $16. I'm like, I could have had an 83 top set for $16. And then you kind of beat yourself up. You go, why did I wait till I was 11 to get into baseball cards? Why wasn't I into it when I was six? But regrets, you know. Fortunately, the prices have all come down for the most part. But again, you know this. Again, if you're around my age, before the internet, where everything was quite literally a click away, the best you could do was get those catalogs and dream. Whether it was Sears, whether it was JCPenney, whether it was a magazine. You know, in my case, as I mentioned in the last podcast, the Amway catalog, going, gee, I hope I can get that box of 800, quote-unquote, out-of-print, random assorted cards, and I hope they're not all 88 tops. I hope there's a few in there that's maybe from the early 80s. But it was so great, even if you did get a bunch of, you know, 88 tops and 87 Donruss cards that were just kind of thrown in there. It was always fun just getting the random collection of cards and just seeing what was in there. You know, you hoped that you had, you know, the Ryan Sandberg rookie card. Of course, reality was that never happened. Never. Of course, they tried to make you think it would happen. But that of course, never happened. But it was always fun, you know, looking through those boxes. And I still have some of the actual boxes. You know, I've repurposed them for storage of other cards. So even now, I look back at some of the boxes that held those cards, and I kind of get a chuckle. It's just like, oh yeah, I remember those. You know, that was right at the top of the Christmas wish list, along with, you know, I would ask for a gift card to my local hobby shop, or I would be very specific. I would say I would like a box of this. And, you know, it was a $20 gift. It was the easiest thing for my parents to pick up. And if my parents didn't understand what I was asking for, they'd send my little brother into the shop and he would pick it up for me. So a lot of great memories from those sets and those times. And I'm glad I was able to spark some memories with you on that. And we're always open for business at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. If you want to share thoughts about our podcast, the players we talk about, or any of the sets or anything you find. I've had people just post pictures, you know, they go to their local card shop and it's like, hey, I heard your podcast about 90 Fleer. I bought a box just for fun. And because it was also like 10 bucks, you know, that's good. It's great to have this little community kind of talking back and forth. So anything you want to post, any questions you have, any suggestions you have for the podcast, post them at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. All right, let's take a look at 91 Tops. We'll get into our random pull of Gary Sheffield in just a little bit. But 91 Tops is one of my favorites because, first of all, it elicits a lot of great memories for me because this was right in the core of my collecting days. And 91 Tops was one of the first boxes that I bought. It was one of the first sets I tried to put together. It was a set full of great memories because there were a lot of great players, but also the card was good. And Topps was running a very special promotion that year. Now, it's funny, this year Topps was celebrating its 65th birthday, and they had all sorts of redemption contests and chances for you to win older cards or old autographed memorabilia and stuff like that. Well, in 1991, Topps was celebrating its 40th anniversary, and this was the first time that Topps took one of these big, nice, round anniversary numbers and really made a big deal of it. You know, you go back to the 25th anniversary set, which would have been the 76 Topps set. There were only a few cards, and it was really more of the then and now kind of series there. You know, here's 1976, here's 1951, and that was it. There was really nothing to it. But Topps pulled out all the stops in 1991. Not only did they randomly insert vintage cards into packages, but if the card was worth more than $50, then they inserted a redemption form, basically. And, you know, you may have won, you know, a Reggie Jackson rookie card or a Mickey Mantle rookie card. So that was the big hook there. And not only did you have a chance at winning these randomly inserted cards, but also you had the chance to register to win the grand prize, which was a copy of each base set from 1951 to 1991, which is incredible when you think about it. And also, you could register to win just a randomly selected set. So you might win the 66 Topps set. And there were some actual winners. You can actually look at Baseballpedia or BaseballCardPedia.com. They actually have a list of some of winners of the bigger sets that we at least know of, or the bigger insert cards. But I know from my experience, I never pulled one of these cards, despite the numerous amount of packs that I bought. But I do know the one or two card shops that I went to that experienced this part of the contest, they pulled something like, they would insert, the 89 Topps Toronto Blue Jays team leaders card. You know, it was really hokey. And Topps would do this again in 2006. You know, this was during their 55th birthday. And this is what helped rope me back into the hobby. In their rack packs, 2006 top rack packs, they would randomly insert a vintage card in each little pocket of the rack pack. So, of course, there's baseball nerd me that goes, hey, I could get a really cool old card. But then reality strikes, you open it up, and your vintage cards are, an 86 Topps Rich Dower, an 87 Topps Marvell Wynn, and then, the dreaded manager card. You know, you would get, a Chuck Tanner card from 1984 or something that got thrown in there. It's just like, oh, gee, thanks. But I was a sucker for it. I kept buying them. Well, the same thing happened when I was a kid, 91 Topps. They had the great promotion, and it really sparked a lot of sales that year. Now, the problem is 91 Topps reportedly printed 4 to 5 million copies of each card. Now, 91 Topps also had several variations of the base set. You had a mini set. You had a Cracker Jack set. You had a Desert Shield set, which was, specially embossed and sent overseas to soldiers in the Middle East. So I don't know if that factors into the overall number there, but we knocked Donruss and Fleer for having a minimum of 3 million cards made those years. Well, 4 or 5 million, good heavens. The one thing that saves Topps is the actual card itself, the design itself. If you take a look at our random pull, card number 68, Gary Sheffield here, let's look at the front. One of the many great things about the 91 Topps set is the photography and the overall design. Now, there is a big, gaudy 40th birthday or 40th anniversary logo in the upper left-hand corner, but you have this really unique frame-within-a-frame look. And you had a lot of great action photos, a lot of really good color shots. Also, I should add, a lot of great stage shots. And one of my favorites is the Roger Clemens card, where Clemens is standing next to the balls and strike count in the Fenway Park scoreboard. And it's a great shot of him just leaning against the wall next to the strike one, strike two, strike three lights. So there were some pretty entertaining stage shots, but certainly the action shots were right up there. And I really like just the overall design of this. So you have that frame within a frame, which was also coordinated to reflect the team color. So for the example, the Milwaukee Brewers here, you have the dark blue outer frame, the gold inner frame. You have the team name in the team script, which was also different. So this was the Milwaukee Brewers team script. If you looked at a card for the Dodgers, it was the Dodger script. If you saw a card for the Mariners, it was that kind of wavy Mariners script. The Blue Jays, you had that, you know, 1977 style, you know, the weird outline script that they had on their jerseys at the time. So that was pretty unique. You didn't have team logos, and you know I'm a big fan of baseball team logos on cards, but you have the secondary script, which I thought was very, very special to this particular project. Right underneath the little bar that has the team name, you have the player name, you have his position over at the far left, and of course Gary Sheffield, back then, still not quite a superstar, he was on his way up, still at shortstop. More about that in a moment. Let's flip the card over. One of my favorite parts of the back of the 91 Topps cards is the color scheme, the design, the red, white, and blue look to it. It's almost kind of an inverse to 84 Topps, where it was predominantly dark blue. Well, here you have this kind of a pinkish red, and you have this blue typeface, or blue text color, I should say. And, you know, white, quote-unquote white, it's the gray cardboard stock, but you still kind of have that same effect there. And underneath all the stats, you have the 40th anniversary logo, which looks kind of neat in this setting here. It is a very clean, easy-to-read, Topps was also starting to get more towards graphics and less text. So you see here, like the 1990 monthly scoreboard, this was something that they started using in 90 Topps. But, trying to break it down, I won't call it sabermetrics, but trying to break it down by the splits, you could see when Gary Sheffield was at his best during the 1990 season. Now, another interesting thing about the 91 Topps set, other than, you know, the design that I love, there's some great rookie cards. Of course, Frank Thomas's rookie card is in here, Chipper Jones as well, and some young stars, including a guy like Gary Sheffield. What's interesting is there are so many variations to the set. And I don't just mean in terms of different types of sets. And I left out Topps Tiffany. That was created that year, too. There were so many errors, statistical errors, and I don't think it's accidental. I think Topps went out of their way because there were so many collectors who were going after error and uncorrected error cards that they figured, hey, we can kind of, you know, toy with the market here by just messing around with a few guys' statistics and, you know, creating a secondary market for error and uncorrected error cards. So there's about 20 or 30 cards in the set. Now, there are some star cards like Don Mattingly, also Dwight Evans, you know, certainly at the end of his career there. So they're not all common cards, but most of the uncorrected errors, or rather the corrected error cards with the, you know, slight changes in statistics are pretty common cards. So I don't think Topps was trying to, you know, jack up the value of certain cards. I think they were kind of hoping what's happened now, you know, these common cards would get used, abused, and thrown out, and then, you know, many years down the line, they would have some kind of value to them. And I know some collectors have added some value to those cards, but I don't know if those are overinflated values because, you know, the more I look at them, it's just like, well, I don't know if this, Keith Comstock wearing, you know, a Mariners jersey, but it says Cubs on it, if that warrants a $40 purchase, I just don't think so. But, it's supply and demand that drives the market, so who knows. But you not only have all those statistical errors, but some collectors have gone as far as to notice that there is a black border or a black edge to the 40th birthday logo banner. Others have said if you shine a UV light on the back of the cards, you know, some cards have a darker print to them, so they stand out more in UV light, you know, black light. And I don't know if any of this was intentional. Personally, I think it's Topps cranking out 5 million cards that year. You're going to have some ink fluctuations. I really don't think that there's supposed to be a dark back, light back, you know, black light, non-black light version. I mean, this is Topps. This was 1991 we're talking about. I don't think they just went from having a standard set in 1990 to having this very sophisticated, you know, black ops way of, you know, finding error cards and different slight, you know, print variations. Maybe I'm wrong, but I really don't think Topps put that much effort into it. So some collectors are really splitting hairs here. There are clearly, like I said, a handful of cards that, for whatever reason, statistics are just way off on the backs of cards, and those were correct, and there is some value to them. But again, remembering that there's anywhere between 4 and 5 million of each of these cards out there, how much are these cards really valued? You could still buy a wax box for $10 to $15. You can buy a complete factory set for $20. You know, I really just don't think there's that much value to these individual cards. My own opinion, but that's not why I like 91 Topps. I don't like 91 Topps just because of, you know, the value of these cards. I like them because of the design. And again, it, you know, it really brings back a lot of great memories. And it's almost an award-winning design. It's very clean. It's very simple. You've got the great photography, again, the unique usage of the, you know, the team script as opposed to the logo, the neat color combination on the back. Pretty good rookie class, pretty good young stars, pretty good superstar collection. 792 card base set. And something else that stands out about this set, this is, in my opinion, the last fun baseball card set. And what I mean by that is, and I've mentioned this before, you know, how Upper Deck raised the bar so much in 1989, and everybody by 1992 had caught up. This was the last basic baseball card. You have the old school cardboard stock, the gray cardboard stock. You have bubblegum not being wrapped in individual pieces. It's still being thrown in there with the cards. Now, granted, Topps started using cellophane wrapping as opposed to wax wrapping that year. You know, you have your basic base set here where you've got rookie cards, you've got first top cards, you have star cards, you have some error cards in there, but you also, you have your all-star cards, you have your record breaker cards, you have your team checklist cards. It's such a basic set. You know, when you look at where the hobby has been between then and now, with chrome refractors and, you know, inserts to subsets and subsets to inserts and autograph cards and redemption cards, and, you know, here's a sliver of Warren Spahn's jockstrap worn in 1962, and we're going to encapsulate that in a special card. You know, it's the hobby, while I think it's good that it's branched out in so many ways, you know, it's also detrimental. It's just like, well, what are they going to throw in there next? You know, some people, that's kind of neat. Well, what are they going to throw in there next? And for others, it's just like, okay, I think we've gone a little too far here, you know, shaving little pieces of, you know, a player, a utility infielder's bat, and putting it in a card and calling it special. So, you know, the hobby has kind of complicated itself along the way. And again, in some ways it's neat, it's good. Other ways it really isn't. But I think when you look back at 91 Topps, and in particular with Topps, because they were one of the last sets to, you know, take their base set and convert it into, you know, something premier. Of course, you know, Stadium Club was their first step towards that. But the Topps base set of 1991 is the last fun basic card set in the hobby, because by 1992, Topps started using better card stock. They had, you know, the pictures of the ballparks on the back of the 92 Topps cards. You know, Fleer would greatly improve their product in 1992. Donruss as well, you know, getting up, you know, good glossy card stock. You had the premium sets, You know, in addition to Upper Deck, you had Stadium Club, you had Fleer Ultra, you had Leaf, you had, you know, Leaf Studio. And, of course, you had Upper Deck and you know, even Bowman, their bass set, tremendously different in 92 compared to 91 with gloss and, you know, gold foil and you know, a real premium on rookie cards. So 91 Tops is, in my opinion, the last great fun set. And here's the good news for you. If you agree with me on this, you can get 91 Tops cards rather easily. Like I mentioned, boxes are cheap, sets are cheap. It does not take much to find a handful of these cards and make a set or just kind of open up packs and see what's out there. So this is another one of those sets where I say, you know, go ahead and invest in it just for fun. Don't try to make any money off of it. You're going to lose your money and lose your mind, too, trying to make your money off of it. This is not like Top Stadium Club where I say collect it and it will maintain its value. I think, you know, it'll be something that you can still proudly show off, you know, 15, 20 years from now. This is just one of those sets where I think you can show it off. I think it's a nice set. But, you know, the value may stay very low and very flat for a very long time because there's just so many of these cards out there. But I think if you take these cards and just collect them, try to put together a set, I think you'll be happy with just neat cards, good pictures, good graphics, you know, and a very special set in the sense that, you know, you can only have one 40th anniversary set. So here it is. And if you're of the same mindset that I am, that is that 91 Tops is the last fun, basic baseball card in the hobby because the hobby changed so much after that, then I think you'll have this nice little piece of history. And it's very affordable. If you're spending more than $20 or $30 pulling together this set, you're probably doing it wrong. Like I said, you can even get a factory set for probably $20, not including shipping, or maybe shipping is included. You know, there's so many of these out there. So I think it's worthy of not only looking at, but, you know, it kind of falls in the same vein of, you know, in my opinion, 90 Fleer or 89 Tops, especially sets that are not going to make you rich, sets that are not going to pay your bills, but sets that I think are real fun to collect and only for a few dollars, literally pennies per card. And I think you'll get some great cards and some great memories, not only now as you're putting it together, but also back then, you know, remembering some of the fun times 25 years ago, pulling together this set. All right, Gary Sheffield, 25 years ago, was just getting his career started as he was with the Milwaukee Brewers. And as I mentioned, it says shortstop on this card. Well, he was kind of sort of a shortstop. He was actually being moved to third base a lot and not to his liking. In fact, he played the race card with the Brewers because they felt that Bill Spires, who was the starting shortstop, well, he felt that he was the starting shortstop only because he was white. It had nothing to do with Spires being a veteran player or perhaps even being a better fielder. But all you have to do is just look at the defensive numbers and you can see why Gary Sheffield was not a big fan of being at third base. Look at 1989, his numbers at shortstop. He had a .959 fielding percentage. Not terrible, but certainly not great. Smaller sample size, only 21 games in 1989 at third base, a 0.937% fielding percentage. That is close to terrible, especially for a third baseman. If you look at his career numbers, when he played shortstop, he had a 961 fielding percentage, and that was only a couple seasons where he was at shortstop. But all the years that he was at third base, and that would be six seasons, 0.932 fielding percentage. So again, when it comes to making the big bucks, it helps when you have a big bat. But if you have a big bat and a pretty good glove, then that's going to help you get those bigger number contracts, those longer term contracts with the better teams. And you won't be stuck with the 1989 Milwaukee Brewers of the world. And I don't think it's a coincidence when he moved to the outfield later on in his career, he really shined there. Left field, 0.966. fielding percentage, right field, 0.981 fielding percentage, and his most productive years on the field. And it really started with the Florida Marlins in the mid-90s. They mostly came during his outfield days, and then later on he would also contribute as a designated hitter, as he still had quite a bit of pop in his bat. And some people say he had a little assistance with that. Oh, wait, we'll get to that in just a moment. As I mentioned, he had a very rocky start with the Brewers, despite being the Brewers' first-round draft pick in 1986. And despite being a star right here in Tampa, Florida, he was an absolute stud with Hillsborough High School, but it actually started way before then. He played in the Belmont Heights Little League, a Little League team that got to the Little League World Series. And he was part of that great crop of Tampa-born players from that era. And I've mentioned this before, guys like Luis Gonzalez, Fred McGriff, also Dwight Gooden, and who else? I'm leaving somebody else out here. Derek Bell was another one. You know, you had so many quality, talented players. Wade Boggs played here. And I'm not even talking about the previous generations of the Lou Piniellas and Tony La Russas and Al Lopez. I'm talking primarily mid to late 70s to mid to late 80s. Dave Magadan was another one. You know, Tampa was just cranking out ball player after ball player after ball player. Well, it wasn't just the neighborhood that Sheffield grew up in. He also had baseball in his blood. His uncle is Dwight Gooden, and Gooden was only 4 years older than Sheffield. And so Sheffield learned how to hit by hitting off of Gooden. So Gooden, of course, was an absolute stud pitcher at the time. So if Gooden is, say, 15, 16 years old, well, if you're an 11 or 12-year-old Gary Sheffield and you could hit a Dwight Gooden fastball back then, you've got a pretty good career coming up with you. So, as I mentioned, he went to the Little League World Series with the Belmont Heights team back in the early 80s. He was a star at Hillsborough High School. He was not only an infielder and, ironically, a third baseman, even though, you know, he tried to be a shortstop. He was also a pitcher. He was the Gatorade National Player of the Year in 1983. And he was just setting the world on fire with his production. So he gets drafted by the Brewers, and almost immediately, it's just an absolutely miserable existence. He's not only fighting the race card fight with Bill Spires and the Brewers on where he should be, but also he was battling injuries. It later came out after he got traded to San Diego, he said, well, I was, you know, purposely committing errors and dropping balls and being a malcontent just so I could get out of there. So he certainly did not warm himself to the Brewers organization or their fans. So he was traded to the Padres just before the 1992 season for Ricky Bonas, Matt Mieske, and Jose Valentin. And with the Padres, he blossoms. And of course, he blossoms with fellow native of Tampa, Fred McGriff. And the Padres, while they didn't make the playoffs or win the World Series during his time there, certainly a much improved team. Very competitive, but a little too competitive for the owner's budget sheet, as he would be traded from the Padres to the Marlins in June of 1993. Now, the Fred McGriff trade from San Diego to Atlanta is best remembered for basically the Padres trading McGriff for a bag of marbles or something very much like that. The three players they got back, very similar in that type of deal. The Padres actually got something of value with the trade to the Marlins. So they trade him and Rich Rodriguez to the Marlins for Andres Beruman, Jose Martinez, and a very young relief pitcher named Trevor Hoffman. I'm sure the Marlins are still regretting doing that. Of course, Hoffman, a tremendous career with San Diego. Now, he stars with the Marlins. Of course, he's moved to the outfield, is productive in the field, at the plate, is just mashing the ball left and right while he is with Florida, has his best offensive season with the Marlins in 1996. He was an all-star that year, 42 home runs, hit 314 that year, led the league in on-base percentage, was actually in the MVP running that year. He was also in the MVP running in 92 with San Diego, but of course the 96 Marlins didn't really grab anyone's attention. They would in 1997. He would win a World Series with them, and all seems peachy king in South Florida. Well, we all know the story of the 97 Marlins. Their owner, Wayne Huizenga, after winning that World Series, breaks up the band, so they trade Sheffield, along with Manuel Barrios, Bobby Bonilla, Jim Eisenreich, and Charles Johnson. They move him to the Dodgers for Todd Zeal and Mike Piazza. Yes, the Mike Piazza trade where Piazza was with the Marlins for like 5 minutes. And there's a lot of thought that this deal was done so that the Dodgers, which were owned by the Fox Television Corporation then, could come up with a regional sports network deal with the Marlins. So there might have been some shenanigans behind the scenes. Boy, that wouldn't shock me one bit. But regardless, Sheffield goes to the Dodgers and has a very productive few years there, despite some injuries along the way. Like I said, he was in the low 300s in batting average, averaging around, I'd say, 40 home runs, a little over 100 RBI during those years. Well, of course, he starts rubbing people the wrong way in Los Angeles, so they very quickly make a deal with the Braves. So they trade him to Atlanta for Andrew Brown, Bryden Jordan, and Odalis Perez. And he has a 2-year fling in Atlanta, again putting up some very good numbers at the plate, but the Braves can't even handle him. So after the 2003 season, he signs as a free agent with the Yankees, and he has an abbreviated career there. He had actually a pretty full season in 2004-2005, all-star seasons, still very productive in his mid-30s, hitting around 290, about 35 home runs. But then he suffered a lot of injuries in the 2006 season, only played 39 games. And at the end of the 2006 season, he's traded to Detroit for Anthony Claggett, Humberto Sanchez, and Kevin Whelan. Now, the Tigers are on the rise. You think this may be the missing piece to the Tigers winning a World Series. They had been to the World Series in 2006, losing to the Cardinals. So they're looking to win it. They think this might be the final piece here. Well, not only do his numbers decline, but he becomes a real pain in the rear end for the Tigers as he gets into hot water for some comments he makes about Latino baseball players. He basically says that, you know, you're going to see more Latin baseball players because they're easier to control than black baseball players. He also, you know, was talking about his time with the Yankees, and he said that Joe Torre treated black players differently than white players. And, you know, this was on HBO's Real Sports, so somebody says, well, wait a minute, Derek Jeter is biracial, and Sheffield adds some fuel to that fire. Well, he's not all the way black. So he had all sorts of attitude problems continuing, even in his later years, which is unfortunate. Got into some brawls, and again, was just a real sourpuss his final season in Detroit. Finally, in 2009, he signs a free agent deal with the New York Mets. Has a pretty decent time there, plays 100 games, 276 batting average, or 276 batting average, excuse me, 10 home runs, 43 RBI. So even at 40 years old, clearly winding down, but he has some career moments going on in his what would turn out to be his final season. He hits his 500th home run on April 17th, 2009. And also, he became the third player in Major League history to hit home runs before age 20 and after age 40, believe it or not. Ty Cobb and Rusty Staub, the only other two players to do that. Alex Rodriguez would later do that. So, it was a productive time in New York. But the Mets didn't want to hang on to a guy who's going to be 41 the next year. So he got into a contract squabble with the Mets. He decides to sit out some games. And unfortunately, his career kind of ends with a whimper. 2009 would be the last major league team he plays for. Kept his options open for 2010, but right before the 2011 season, officially announced his retirement. Now, more controversy. He was linked to steroid use. Now, he said that, you know, once he used a cream to try to heal some, torn stitches on his knee, or at least a trainer used this cream, claimed that he had no idea that steroids might be in it. And he says, you know, it didn't really help me anyways. Look at my numbers. Well, he is in the Mitchell Report as being a player who obtained and used steroids. So lots of controversy surrounding his career in the latter stages and during his post-career time. And you just look at his Hall of Fame numbers and you can see that whether you buy the argument that, well, this may or may not have had steroids in it, and it may or may not have helped my career, his Hall of Fame percentage for votes hovering just under 12%. So it doesn't look good for him there. And that's, unfortunate because you look at his career numbers, and despite the injuries, despite the temper tantrums, despite getting shuffled around from team to team, had a 22-year career, hit 509 home runs, a 292 batting average, and 1,676 RBI, 2689 in the hit column. Pretty good career, but unfortunately tainted by a lot of nonsense before, during, and after his pro career, because he got into trouble a few times as a teenager as well, which is well documented. Just look at the Dwight Gooden story, and you'll see Gary Sheffield is attached to some of those rather unpleasant stories along the way. So even though Sheff's career was not that great, the card that he's on here, card number 68, is a great one, part of one of my favorite sets, the 91 top set. Again, I'd encourage you, go ahead, spend a few bucks, see what you get. You can put together a complete set rather cheaply, and because I feel this was the last great simple baseball card set in the hobby, because it's totally different 25 years ago compared to now, this may be a keepsake for you. This was the last one on the cheaper card stock with the basic backs, with the nice photography of a very basic design, no gloss, gum was still packaged with the cards. It's kind of a neat little throwback, and it's pretty affordable to get your hands on it. So there you go, 91 Tops, Gary Sheffield. Feel free to talk about either of those or anything you want on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And don't forget, on Tuesday, we'll take a look back at the 92 Bowman set, or first look back at the 1992 sets. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks so much again for listening to another edition of Wax Ecstatic.